You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Thank you for joining us today, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if I'm in the same sardonic mood I was yesterday. I re-listened to part of the show yesterday. There are some days I just come in and I'm in a mood. Today I would say I'm in a similar mood. However, I will be very overjoyed to speak to my friend Kevin Baker, the amazing the historian and writer, author. He's the author of a great historical trilogy of New York City. The trilogy is known as City of Fire. It comprises of Stryver's Row, Dreamland, and Paradise Alley. He, of course, writes for the New York Times and Harper's. He will be here to talk to us about the Shirtwaist Triangle Factory fire, which will be having its 100th anniversary, I guess, in just maybe tomorrow, actually. He will be here to join us, talk about that. Maybe it's Saturday. I'm not quite sure. But he will tell us about that story. And the union reforms and worker safety reforms it brought about in this country, some people believe that it was actually the beginning of the push for the New Deal. So we'll be speaking to him about that shortly. And I want to say kudos to Ginny Thomas. She has just joined the crew over at Daily Caller. I'll read you the PR or part of the PR notice. Longtime Washington policy leader Ginny Thomas, founder of the group Liberty Central, has agreed to join the Daily Caller. The Daily Caller, of course, that Tucker Carlson. I'm not sure if it's. I'm not sure if Breitbart wants to be Tucker Carlson or Tucker Carlson wants to be Breitbart. But these are guys who are very unsatisfied with themselves, and clearly the lengths and the desperation they'll go to become more relevant is it's always impressive on the right. Ginny is always upbeat. She has an unbelievable amount of energy and enthusiasm, and she knows our political system as well as anyone in Washington. We could not imagine a better person to take on this role, blah, 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 fourth major hire, blah, blah. Daily Caller's special correspondent, Thomas, will interview key political and community leaders from high-profile politicians. Grassroots activists will focus on listening to those outside the Beltway. Before founding Liberty Central, Thomas opened Hillsdale College's Washington office and was with the Heritage Foundation for nearly 10 years as a director of government relations and senior fellow, blah, 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 blah. Evan, do you know who Ginny Thomas is?
It would be Clarence Thomas as well.
That's right. Oddly, that didn't make it into the PR notice. Wow. That's pretty shocking. One wonders if she will be... calling all of Clarence Thomas's critics from her offices at the Daily Caller to demand apologies. I guess it depends on whether or not what type of alcohol they serve in the vending machines over the Daily Caller. And notice, she has been on the right-wing welfare dole since almost the day her husband was nominated. And continues to be. That's not a conflict of interest. No, of course not. That doesn't even seem like a conflict of interest. And Clarence Thomas worries about the institution of the Supreme Court. So kudos to her. Congratulations. So hard to get a break. So hard for some people to get a break. Meanwhile, in our latest shiny war, and we'll talk more about, you know, I'm happy to engage in my perspective of our engagement over there in Libya. I am actively ambivalent about this. Actively ambivalent. But an American F-15E fighter jet crashed in Libya overnight, reportedly near a field in Benghazi. One crew member has been recovered while the other is in the process of recovery, whatever that means. The crash was supposedly caused by mechanical fire, not hostile fire, whatever that means. The military campaign to destroy air defenses and establish a no-fly zone over Libya has nearly accomplished its initial objectives. Presumably, this is from the United States. There is confusion amongst the Western powers engaged in this as just to who is going to carry out the military operations going forward once and if the United States drops back. The president said in a letter to Congress, according to the New York Times, that he had the power to authorize the strikes, which would be limited in duration and scope, and that preventing a humanitarian disaster in Libya was in the national interest. He has to say that it's in the national interest to fall within the War Powers Act, which many people think is unconstitutional to begin with. That's a hard road to hoe, I think. To claim that the prevention of a humanitarian crisis in Libya is somehow in the U.S. national interest, because there's a lot of humanitarian crises around the world that we do not engage in. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the Security Council rejected a request from Libya for a meeting to discuss the situation. Remember, this is sanctioned by the U.N. And, like I say, I want to get into this more in the post-show, but I think there is a legitimate argument that U.S. military force, if it can be used to provide a net gain of human life, in other words, prevent a greater massacre, because exercise of military power always involves the killing of civilians. It always does. It never not does. But if it can provide for a net outcome that saves lives and simultaneously is sanctioned by the UN, there's an argument for that. And then the next argument is how do you look into the future and determine whether or not it's going to be a net savings of lives? And I think there's some validity to the argument. You need to allow the United Nations to be the arbiter of that, because in the real world, there is no way to really measure that. With that said, I am still skeptical. In Santiago, Chile, Mr. Obama restated the United States would turn over full responsibility to the allies to maintain the no-fly zone. But this is key. He also sought to distinguish the stated goals of the United Nations authorized military operation, protecting Libyan civilians, establishing a no-fly zone, and forcing Gaddafi's withdrawal from the cities, with his own administration's demand, not included in the United Nations resolution, that Gaddafi had to leave office. I don't know what that means in a practical sense. In a rhetorical, political sense, if he does nothing to carry forward that policy unilaterally speaking, he is showing respect for international norms and law, quote unquote. So take that for what it will. One interesting thing that's come out of this, well, we'll play this audio later. Later in the program, we'll play this audio of CNN correspondent Nick Robertson slamming Fox News. I've never seen anything like this coming, particularly from a war correspondent, on essentially the disinformation they're putting out there and their hypocrisy and for being incredibly lazy and cowardly in their reporting. I mean, it's a stunning clip. We'll play it later in the show. I want to get to this other news. The Wall Street Journal had a piece in the past couple days that with the 2008 financial crisis and recession that has continued, we are looking at a resurrection, essentially, of debtors' prisons. Some lawmakers, and of course the Wall Street Journal puts this in the context of reporting on how there is pushback by the system on this use of prisons as a way of forcing debt to be repaid. Some lawmakers, judges, and regulators are trying to rein in the U.S. debt collection industry use of arrest warrants to recoup money owed by borrowers who are behind on credit card payments, auto loans, and other bills. Understand, this is the way it works with the media. And this is the way that media spin meisters work. You want to get out ahead of a story. So if the story comes out that I have embezzled all of the Majority Report funds to hang out with Charlie Sheen and do illicit drugs on the chests of strippers in Atlantic City, as soon as I get wind that this story is going to break, and it's inevitable, what I will do is I will have Evan put out a press release saying that I apologize for this so that you get the information in the context of my apology. I have thereby sort of quashed the lurid details of the story, made it a secondary story. The story is my apology. That's the way, understand, that's the way you need to read media. So this story comes out in the guise of, oh, some people are trying to work on this problem, as opposed to, hey, this is a really fucked up situation. Just earned my explicit rating on iTunes. More than a third of all U.S. states allow borrowers who can't or won't pay to be jailed. Judges have signed off on more than 5,000 such warrants since the start of 2010 in nine counties with a total population of 13.6 million. So it's much bigger than this. It's just that nobody keeps records on it. In interviews, 20 judges across the nation said the number of borrowers threatened with arrest in their courtrooms has surged. Earlier this month, Washington State's House of Representatives passed by a 98-0 vote a bill that would require companies to provide proof a borrower has been notified about lawsuits against them before a judge could issue an arrest warrant. So you've had a situation where these people could just lose the warrants. They could be through malfeasance or misfeasance, not even tell people they're being sued, and then just immediately have them jailed. See, again, we're hearing of the proactive measures to stop this. Illinois regulators are investigating the use of warrants by debt collectors and other financial firms doing business in that state. One guy spent 5 days in a Carbondale, Illinois judge jail last March after failing to pay a $275 debt. Last year, officials in McIntosh County, Oklahoma, issued about 1,500 debt-related arrest warrants. That's double the amount that took place before the crisis. Frankly, I don't know why there's any. I mean, I can't tell you the float that some of these corporations, I've done, you know, occasionally I've done a video here or done video there. I've got news for you. Work for GE, it takes you literally like months to get paid. Can I throw them in jail? No. Emmy Nichols, 26 years old, was arrested in June at her mother's house after lawyers for Capital One and Corp won an arrest warrant against her for skipping court hearing about $1,100 owed on a credit card. Jeffrey Stearns answered a knock at the door in Hancock County, Indiana. The deputy was holding a warrant to arrest Stearns for not paying $4,000 owed to AIG on a loan for his pickup truck. Whatever happened to repo? After being handcuffed in front of his four children, Stearns, 29 years old, spent two nights in jail, where he was strip searched and sprayed for lice. "I didn't even know I was being sued," he said. "It isn't dispute that he owes the money. It's the scariest thing that ever happened to me." Well, that'll teach him. Back in the 1830s, we supposedly stopped jailing people for debt. I love that. Why not let the market take care of it? Why not let the market take care of it? You have a means in which to tell whether or not people pay their credit card bills. I mean, it's almost impossible not to get that information online. An accidental search will get you this type of information. Let the market take care of it. If you see someone has bad credit, you don't give them a credit card. Next time you know. But instead, we have our government resources focused on this. I've got much more news to go, but I want to call Kevin Baker. He is waiting. So let's take a break. And more news coming up. And in a moment, Kevin Baker on the Shirtwaist Fire Factory. Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot tell you how overjoyed I, Sam Cedar, am to welcome back to the Majority Report one of our earliest guests on Majority Report 1. He is an author, a writer, a bon vivant, Kevin Baker, author of my favorite New York historical trilogy, City of Fire, including Stryver's Row, Dreamland, Paradise Alley. We will have links to that, and that'll be up in our book club later today. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, Kevin, when exactly is the anniversary of the Shirtwaist Triangle Fire?
The 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire is this Friday, March 25th. It took place March 25th, 1911. And it was really one of the seminal moments in American labor history and American overall social history. Francis Perkins said that the day the New Deal started was actually March 25th, 1911.
And who was Francis Perkins?
Frances Perkins was this wonderful social worker at the time, back when social workers actually set social policy in part, this absolutely fearless, very Christian woman from Western Mass, who went into the city ghettos in New York and Philadelphia and worked very hard for people there, also became an astute political lobbyist. Used to wear her hat in a little, I'm sorry, let me just close this.
Oh, person. We can take care of this in editing.
Okay, great. Hang on a sec. Hello. Sorry about that. So, she was this very astute political lobbyist. She used to wear these little black hats, tri-cornered hats, that reminded old Irish machine politicians of their mothers. And she was, lobbying very much for, she was a terrific person. She would go around, she'd be threatened by pimps in the ghetto, and she would yell out at them their real names, which used to kind of humiliate them and embarrass them out of fear that their mothers would find out about this. You know, really on the street, hardworking person, trying to bring social change in New York. And she actually happened to be in the Village having tea with a friend when the Triangle Fire broke out. So she actually ran to the site of it and witnessed it.
And she actually, she turned out to be the first female labor secretary.
She went on to become the first female labor secretary. She, you know, from the Triangle Fire, she was the one on the commission investigating working conditions, wages and hours, along with Robert Wagner and Al Smith, who were the heads of the New York State Assembly.
All right, well, let's, before we get to Al Smith, in particular, let's just back up a little bit.
Yeah,
We're talking 100 years ago. It is the early 1900s. We've just gone through the aughts at that time.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of where the country was at. Where, you know, what was happening in terms of wealth distribution? What was happening in terms of immigrants? What was happening in terms of any type of labor movements at that time?
Yeah, the okay, so 1911, you just had this these huge waves of immigration coming in. You had what was sort of continuous class warfare in the workplace in America. 37,000 strikes between 1885 and 1905, most of them settled in very bloody manners.
37,000 strikes now, is that nationally?
That's nationally in 20 years.
Wow.
And constant bloodshed in these strikes, constantly the owners calling in private goons, calling in the state militia, calling in the local police to settle the strikes by beating and sometimes killing people. You know, the Ludlow Massacre in 1914, the 1892 Homestead Strike in 1892, you know, these bloody confrontations. And it was just sort of also a continual slaughter just going on in the regular workplaces in America. You know, Beverly Gage, the labor historian, estimates that there were 100 deaths a day at the workplace.
Wow.
Just from industrial accidents. At the time of the Triangle, around the time of the Triangle Fire. This is in a country that had a population less than a third of what it does today. So this was, you know, the kind of conditions people lived under and worked under all the time.
And so there were labor movements and protests in New York, obviously 37,000 happening around the country.
Right.
And so then take us up to tell us about the this factory and who worked there and what happened.
Sure. Well, about a year and a half before the Triangle Fire, there was this huge strike of all these working women in the factories and the sweatshops around New York City, all these garment workers. It was called the Uprising of the 20,000. And it was really sort of this spontaneous strike that sprung out of just all these young women fed up with the conditions they were working in. And nobody thought it was possible because the sweatshops and the garment factories were all scattered around. There were thousands of them. Nobody thought you could get all these women together. Also, the fact was that they were from all these various ethnic groups, a lot of young Jewish women, a lot of Italian women, some Norwegians. Nobody thought you were going to get all these people who literally spoke different languages together. But it was a remarkable story of organizing. These women went out and did it on their own. A lot of them just teenage girls. They were called the Febrente Medlac, the fiery girls. And they went out and made speeches in the street corner, organized this, this union. They were brutally attacked by the owners who had the local police, along with pimps and prostitutes, go and attack them on the picket lines and try to jail them. Some wealthy women came to their aid in a great kind of moment of feminist solidarity. But they fought the strike out, and they won recognition in a lot of places. They started the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, the ILGWU, one of the great unions in American history. But they didn't win every place. And one of the places they didn't win was the Triangle Factory. The Triangle Factory is on three stories building in Greenwich Village, not far from Washington Park. It's on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors. And it was considered something of a model factory compared to, say, working in your living room or working in many of the other like real sweatshops of the time.
Because at that time, if I'm not mistaken, that's how basically the garment industry was. You would get people in apartments and they would go around. This was actually bringing everybody together in one space.
Yeah, it was a horrible thing. In fact, if you go down to the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, a wonderful museum which recreated an old tenement, and they have a great illustration of how you worked, which was you'd be in the living room of this tiny apartment with like two or three outside hands you'd brought in maybe to sew and press and churn out these garments at a ridiculous rate. You know, it was a horrible system where everybody was squeezing everybody. The big retailers wanted this stuff as cheap as possible. So they squeeze the wholesalers and they squeeze the subcontractors right down to the bottom where people were just kind of, working for nothing, for barely survival wages in these horrible conditions, which really lent themselves to things like tuberculosis, disease. People just wore out working at this stuff. So the Triangle Fire was supposed to be something better. It had big windows. It had benches. And, it was supposed to be scientifically set up. It was high up, so you had a little air. It was considered a real improvement, and it was. On the other hand, you were still being worked at like a back-breaking pace. You were not allowed to talk. You had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. You were supposed to churn out a huge number of shirtwaists, these sort of popular women's blouses, every day. You were charged if you broke a needle. You were charged if you ruined a piece of cloth. You had to bring your own sewing machines in, provide your own equipment, in other words. And by like midday, it was reported that the air would be so thick with lint that they'd have to turn on the lights to see, even with all the windows and everything. So this was really just a horrible way to work.
Now, I should also say, too, that this was a pretty big building for that time, too, wasn't it? 11 stories?
Yeah. It was called the Ash Building, and it was built to be non-flammable, which it was. The building itself was fireproofed. It's still there. It's now a part of NYU. It's called the Brown Building. But unfortunately, the things inside it, the people and the garments, were not were flammable.
Now, let me ask you this. You got these workers, they're working 12, probably 14 hours a day. They're all predominantly women. They range in ages probably from 12 years old, maybe up to who knows how old. They're getting minimum wages at all. They're having to pay for their own equipment. They get no breaks. Why didn't they just go GALT? I mean, why didn't they just have an option to go work somewhere else?
Because that's the best you could expect. These owners everywhere all got together, and this is the sort of way you had to work. Yeah, as you say, they worked like 12, 14 hours a day more during the season. Then they were laid off when whatever season it was, depending on what you were putting out. When that ended, you could just be laid off. Like, that's it. Too bad. Go scramble for work somewhere else. You had big signs in the lobby saying things like, "If you don't come in on Saturday," which was the day off, of course, it was the Sabbath for a lot of the Jewish workers. "Don't come in on Monday." So you were expected to violate all your religious beliefs.
Now, my understanding is that the factory was owned by two Jews.
It was owned by, wonderful couple of people, Max Blank and Isaac Harris. And like a number of factory workers, they themselves had worked their way up as garmentos to owning a factory. And that's what a number of these people did through incredible hard work and ingenuity. You'd start your own little shop in an apartment, and you might work up to be a factory owner. It was the American dream. But then once you were there, you were sticking it to everybody below you. Right. One point they wanted these workers to work overtime, and they promised to pay them for this, really overtime. They paid them in like stale pumpkin pies that they had gotten from some bakery for nothing.
Wow.
This hugely exploitative. And also, unfortunately, they had a real tendency they would insure all their all their fabric, which was called lawn, all their cloth. And then at the end of the season, when you had all this insured inventory, they had this habit of having these mysterious fires break out in their various factories where all the cloth would get destroyed. and they make some handsome settlement on the on the cost of that from the insurance company. They'd get a nice payoff on that. So these are people who they didn't set the Triangle fire, but they had they were actually on site at the time, but they had very little interest in preventing fires from happening in their factories. In fact, they planned on it.
I want to get to that because I know that they did quite well. I mean, financially with this fire, as horrible as it sounds. But give me a sense. Your average worker there, she goes home. Give me a sense of what her life at home briefly is like, and then give me a sense of what blank when he goes home. Where does he go? What is his home life like at this time?
Oh yeah, Blank and Harris were living quite well. I think they were up on Fifth Avenue by that point. They had servants, they had chauffeurs for themselves and their wives. At a time when very few people had cars, they had a couple apiece. Whereas your average garment worker went home to her tiny tenement fire trap, usually lived with her family, and you might live in an apartment where, say, in one room, the mother and father would have, like, the one bed. Everybody else, brothers and sisters, would all be laid out on the floor or on, on a couple of chairs put together, which is how a great many people slept in the old Lower East Side ghettos. One bathroom in the hallway for the entire floor. Incredibly tough way to live.
So the disparity here is pretty pronounced. I mean, pretty pronounced is an understatement, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the disparity was horrendous in New York at the time. Just an immense gulf between the wealthy and the poor. For the poor, a lot of them, this was still a better deal than how they'd had it in Europe, where, say, in the Pale of Russia, you would actually fear for your life during a pogrom, or in the south of Italy, where you were, we were just treated living under medieval conditions. So this was something of an improvement, but it was a very, very hard way of life. We tend to think of the immigrant experience as everyone came here, worked hard, made money, success. In fact, the immigrant experience was all about loss. It was all about death to a great degree. You had parents whose kids Americanized before them and went off. You had fathers abandoning families because they just couldn't find a way to support them. You had people torn away from this very traditional pastoral life, plunked down to the city, and often just sort of worked to death. It was a very hard way to make it in America.
And give me a sense, how many people, I remember that, come the 1920s, I remember hearing a statistic about one of those walking tours down downtown. How many people were literally living on the street in the Bowery at this time?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, the Bowery was terrible. There were probably hundreds, if not thousands. I mean, there were also, there were prostitutes all over the place, women who just couldn't take, couldn't sew or just couldn't take this sort of life. They used to call them the soiled doves. They'd be under the elevated railroads, which are all around the place. Thousands of prostitutes in New York, suffering terribly. I mean, there were kids living on the street all over the place. The papers tended to refer to them as street Arabs, which implied that they were of great adventure living on the street in New York. One of them, the Baxter Street dudes, actually formed, they were basically a gang of kid thieves. They actually formed their own child theater, among other things.
Wow.
It was just sort of this whole culture. And it was, it was very, very tough, in most of New York to kind of make a living,
Okay.
And you picture these conditions, yeah.
So tell me about what takes place now. They go into work on 100 years ago, almost to the day.
Yeah.
And what happens that day at the Shirtwaist Triangle?
Yeah, it was a nice, clear, warm Saturday afternoon. It was a half-day Saturday, which meant you got off work at 5 o'clock. Hmm. So it's a quarter of 5. They're getting ready to go. They're getting up on their, putting on their coats, a lot of these young women. Outside in Greenwich Village, people are strolling around. It's a nice part of the village, then as now. Some of them notice a little smoke in the sky, and they see these bundles come flying out of the ninth-story window at the Ash Building. And a number of people say, oh, it must be the proprietor. He's trying to save his lawn. He's trying to save his inventory. And then they notice the bundles hit with a particular sound. They notice that some of them smash right through the sidewalk, sidewalk deadlights there. And they've come to realize that these are actually women jumping out the window. What had happened was on the eighth floor, where they had the cutters, the people who cut out the fabric, had these huge felt bins, which they saved and they sold for pennies, you know, a ton to the felt dealers. They sold the scraps of fabric to the felt dealers. Somebody had probably dropped a lighted cigarette butt in one of those. And it, they still don't know for sure, but he probably had dropped the lighted cigarette butt and everything went right up. They caught on the patterns, which were strung along a clothesline. These tissue patterns for the shirtwaist, and quickly set the whole eighth floor on fire. You know, there are workers on the eighth, ninth, and tenth. Almost all the ones on the eighth managed to get out. They just ran down the stairs. Almost all the ones on the tenth got out. They went up to the roof, including Blank and Harris, and went over to, they were helped over to the building next door by NYU med students. The people on the ninth were quickly trapped. They were trapped in part because Blank and Harris insisted that all the women's pocketbooks be checked at the end of every day because they were afraid they might steal a couple of these scraps of cloth that were selling for, you know, literally, you know, pennies a ton. They didn't want them stealing that. So the, you know, so most of the doors were locked. You had, fire hoses that didn't work. Because again, they didn't really want people putting out the fire when they burned the inventory at the end of the season. A number of women scrambled out onto the fire escape, but it was poorly made and didn't hold them. They plunged down through through a glass skylight and/or were impaled on a iron fence below. And out the front, you know, the elevator operator was very valiant, kept bringing the car back and up and down. But eventually, they just couldn't do that anymore. So a number of women jumped down the elevator shaft. One of them lived by wrapping fabric around her hands and going down on the cable there. But most of these women died on top of the elevator. You know, the people scrambling out of the elevator could hear them falling on the top of it. Most of them, though, were trapped at the front windows along... I think it's Washington Place there, and they had to, Washington Place, and they had to, they really had nowhere to go. They're up on the ninth story, and they're trapped here. There's a crowd that's gathered very quickly below them, and is calling for them not to jump. You know, the fire department is coming. And the fire department did come very quickly, 2 minutes, scrambled out there with the hook and ladder companies and the hoses, and they have no ladders that go up beyond the sixth story, which is 30 feet short of where they're supposed to be. You know, all the hoses do from that level is to kind of create what the feeling of a light rain. And this fire is raging behind these women, starting to, you know, lap up on their dresses there, and they start to jump. You know, a lot of them jumping in twos and threes, you know, holding hands. They go plunging right down. The firemen try to hold out these life nets. They go plunging right through them. Something like 90 women, many of them, again, teenage girls, died this way in front of their fellow New Yorkers. And it's just this remarkable tragedy that sickened the watching police officers who'd just been beating these girls months before. It horrified the crowd there. 146 people dead, 129 of them women, in the space of 15 minutes. And this is what finally convinces people that something has to be done about the way people live and work in the city.
And we should say at this time, it wasn't as if there wasn't technologies that exist. They had sprinkler technology. They had, obviously fire escape technology. They had all these technologies, but there was just no requirement that they use them. And there was no incentive for, these owners to, in fact, use them because they were so well insured that, in fact, the owners of this company made money on this fire.
Yes, the owners actually hired a very smart lawyer who managed to beat the manslaughter raps against them. They made some piddling settlement with the survivors, but overall, even taking that into account, they made money from the insurance on the whole fire. They went off, they started another factory, and a few months later were caught with all the same fire violations they had had before. They finally went off somewhere else and changed their names and everything. But
see, that's really the yeah. most telling thing about this.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, it could just have easily been that you just would have just said, and these two men lived with intense regret their entire lives and
yeah.
did everything they could to reverse this what happened that day by deed, by desire, whatever it was. And in fact, no, they just went on and did the exact same thing and just were lucky enough not to have another fire.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one of them even had his own daughters on site the day of the fire. And so, of course, he got them to safety and got himself to safety. But for everybody, you know, it's a great metaphor for the economy. And for everybody else, be damned, just get yourself to safety, no matter what cause you had in it. You know, there's another interesting point, too, in the wake of Wisconsin and everything that's going on with public employee unions in this country now, which is the fact that here you were in a city that was already full of skyscrapers, and nobody had bothered to figure out, maybe we should try to find some way to make sure people can get out of these really tall buildings safely. And the reason for that was because government wasn't about serving the people. Government was about making money, much as, you know, the Republicans would have it be that way today. You know, the policeman who had just been beating the strikers the year before, to become a beat cop in New York at the time, you paid $200 for the privilege, which is a huge amount of money. You paid $1,400 if you wanted to make a lieutenant, $14,000 if you wanted to make captain. And the way you made up this money was you openly solicited bribes from all the criminals and from the business people who you were supposed to be protecting. You know, and this, you were beholden to the corrupt political authorities who worked hand in glove with manufacturers and businesses of all time. And so you would often be ordered out in the street to beat up working people. To have some kind of thin veil of legality over this, they brought the pimps and the prostitutes they controlled and had them start fights with the strikers, and then they'd have an excuse to go in and beat these women bloody and haul them off to, you know, to court. You know, the New York firemen, by contrast, were very valiant, but they just didn't have the equipment. Nobody worried about things like, oh, how can we get a ladder up to the ninth floor? Should we have sprinklers required? You know, that didn't put government on a paying basis. Government was, you know, was essentially privatized. It was all about, you know, government workers were hired at the whims of whoever happened to be in office. They had no protection. There was no civil service to speak of. You know, this was the kind of brave new world the Republican Party foresees for us. It actually existed 100 years ago in America, and the result was what happened at the Triangle Fire.
And, you know, we should say that, you know, it didn't necessarily have to change. In other words,
yeah.
You can look at other, you know, third world economy. You can look to Saipan. You can look to sweatshops in China. You can look all around the world for examples of economies and situations that are not terribly different from that situation 100 years ago in this country.
Oh yeah, I mean it's, you know, Nicholas Kristof of the Times, whose heart is in the right place, but always writing these columns about how sweatshops are good, you know, and sweatshops exist all over the third world, and he always compares them like, well, they're good compared to dump picking, you know, and I guess that's true, but you know, sweatshops are not a way forward, and we like to pretend that they are. You know, the model for sweatshops is that they will last forever. Most of the workers will never make enough money to get ahead, and, you know, the elite few will dominate this and, you know, turn out cheap goods for their consumer base. You know, and this is what, you know, you have awful sweatshops in Bangladesh and India, all over the world today. where America, oftentimes where American corporations have outsourced these things because they can't get away with whatever they want to here in the U.S. I mean, a great example, even with the Jack Abramoff scandals, was in the Northern Marianas Islands,
right,
where they set up a huge island-wide sweatshop, which led to, you know, mass rapes of the workers, which led to just all kinds of horrible working conditions and exploitation of people and environmental disaster. You know, it's
but to be fair, great golf opportunities for Tom Dillon.
Great golf opportunity, and you know, and it speaks of the whole hypocrisy of this. You know, like one of the people very involved in this was Grover Norquist. You know, and it's sort of this whole nonsense of pretending that he hates government. Well, I don't know of any government that's as intrusive as that. They have total power whether you live and die, and can rape you at will. You know, it's like that's, you know, you can call that not government, but I don't understand, like, you know, what the hell he's talking about when that's the replacement regime.
You know? Kevin, we've got to wrap this up in a minute or two, but at the end of the day, you know, if you strip away the obvious hypocrisy and the obvious inconsistency of government intrusion or intervention in one way, i.e., you know, we pay the cops. If you wipe that away, at the end of the day, what you're really talking about is making a choice. Which society, which model do you want? Because the arguments about what the framers wanted, or the consistency of sort of broad philosophies about libertarianism versus, you know, and free market versus command and control, all of that, you can find intellectual inconsistencies on, you know, in any ideology. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to what is your vision for society? Is it the one that existed in 1909, or is it the one that we aspire to, where we move towards a more just society, and one where workers have a certain amount of rights to safety and to fair conditions, and consumers have certain safety and protections? I mean, that's ultimately what it boils down to, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was very much what came about. You know, all these people involved with the fire, you know, with cleaning up after the fire, even if Blank and Harris didn't care, people like Francis Perkins and people like Robert Wagner and Al Smith in the New York State Legislature passed all these sweeping reforms in New York. And then later on, Wagner particularly with the right to organize, and Perkins, who wrote much of the Social Security Act and was the first labor secretary under FDR, first woman cabinet member, they passed all this sort of stuff, which really changed the way in which we live, and made for a much better society, any way you measure it, a much more prosperous one, widely prosperous one, a much fairer one, a much more humane one. You know, if one has no sense of morality about this at all, you have to consider just like the huge economic boom that went on in this country, you know, after the New Deal and all. You just can't, you need consumers, if nothing else. And the people being paid these tiny wages down in the shirtwaist factories, they couldn't afford to buy shirtwaists. You know, they were dressed in this sort of old world garb. You know, you had people who couldn't afford to put out the goods we were making.
Kevin Baker, obviously I could talk to you all day about this, and we'll have you back on, and we will continue this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. If I can put in a plug for the events on the day, the 25th.
Please.
Look up the Remember the Triangle Coalition at rememberthetriangle.org, which will have all these events are planned, marches, the chalking of names of the victims. There's a terrific theatrical piece that's going to be in regard to from the New School by Elizabeth Suarez called From the Fire. That's the 23rd through the 27th. A lot of terrific events to do with this, and I may have an article in Politico about it too. So,
okay. Well, we will link to the article. We will link to that site on majority.fm. And Kevin, we'll talk to you soon about this. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. I still have some news to do. Super extra bonus style for you non-members. We'll be right back. Bye. Got another couple of minutes of stories here for you in the post-show today, the members-only post-show. I will be giving you an update on my grape cloning experiment, and I'm still debating about this. I don't know if I'll do it today. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow. But I, you know, I'm interviewing people to replace Dorsey, and one interview, the whole story. I'll talk about it in the post show. And if folks, if you can become a member, please do. You don't know what you're missing. Not to mention the fact that it supports this program. Without your support as a member, we cannot continue. That's what keeps us going. And you can always go to justcoffee.coop. Also, I got iced coffee today for the first time in ages. Went over there. They raised it a quarter. Like almost 12% increase. So you go to justcoffee.coop, you can get a 10% discount by using the coupon code MAJORITY. And on top of that, it's fair trade coffee. Everybody who works there owns a part of the company. It's awesome. They have been sponsors of this program since day one. And they supported Break Room Live, on and on. And, of course, every purchase you make through that Amazon link, you redistribute money from those corporate lackeys into our little sweatshop here. Speaking of consumer product safety, and this story by Steve Bannon, did I talk about Representative Mike Pompeo, Republican of Kansas, who was trying to kill the Consumer Product Safety database? This is a database that was going to be that will be set up, where Americans can go online, get totally free access on information about the safety records of household products. And this dude was trying to kill that bill. Now, why? Why would you do that? What possible? It's, first of all, it's completely contrary to the agenda of libertarians and free market. If everybody has the same information, no. He wants to kill that because if consumers are made aware of potentially dangerous products, consumers may not buy them. And if they don't buy them, it would hurt their profits. As it turned out, writes Steve Bannon, the Koch brothers were the ones who wanted the online consumer product safety database scuttled, and Pompeo was happy to do their bidding. He represents the district where Koch Industries is located, and the Koch brothers and their political action committee were his most generous campaign contributors.
Surprise, surprise.
Koch brothers, they make all sorts of like household products. I don't know what it is, like paper products, a bounty, whatever it is. Look it up. You can find it in what do you call it? Just don't buy their products. And then over last weekend, he reports that the Washington Post had a piece noting that Pompeo is also trying to gut an EPA registry of greenhouse gas polluters.
Surprise, surprise.
Another Koch brothers goal. And has hired a former Koch Industries lawyer as his chief of staff.
Surprise.
Boy, I wonder if he's making more money. I wonder if his sole source of income, this former lawyer of the Koch brothers, is just being chief of staff of this guy. I wonder if he's going to spend the rest of his career in government service. I wonder.
I don't think so.
It would be fascinating to track this one guy and see how long he works in this guy's chief of staff, or doesn't go back to work for the Koch brothers at a much greater salary. I mean, it's poetry of corruption. Mary Boyle of Common Cause says, same old story, member of Congress carrying water for his biggest campaign contributor. I don't know how you make the argument to your constituents that it's in their interests to defund the EPA or a consumer database. Bridget Loomis,
Political science professor adds, I'm sure he would vigorously dispute this, but it's hard not to characterize him as the congressman from Coke. Meanwhile, a different GOP bill would force the IRS to conduct abortion audits. I spoke of this briefly in the memberships show, I think over the past couple of days, but under a GOP bill, which is expected to sail through the House of Representatives, the IRS would be forced to police how Americans have paid for their abortions to ensure that taxpayers complied with the law. IRS agents would have to investigate whether certain terminated pregnancies were the result of rape or incest. So in other words, if you have a health savings account, if you have subsidized health care, if you use any pre-tax dollars, get a deduction for health care, whatever it is. Because in the mind of these Republicans, despite the fact that they'll say that tax money is yours, it's not the government's, if you don't give all of the tax money that's due because you have some type of tax deferral or tax credit and use that money to pay for abortions, they will investigate you to make sure you're in compliance with federal law. Do you understand the sick, twisted mind that's involved in this now? We hear over and over again, it's not the government's money. It's the American taxpayers' the money. Except for when you get a tax credit or a tax deferral and you decide to spend that money on an abortion. On a perfectly legal, acceptable medical practice. Imagine if we applied this reasoning to the tax credits given to corporations that come into a local municipality and get tax breaks, to churches that don't have to pay taxes on the property they own, to businessmen, to corporations who get tax write-offs, who gets tax credits, who get moratorium on repatriating their international profits. I mean, can you imagine if we applied this? It would be stunning. No church would ever be able to discriminate against gay people. No university would ever be able to have racial issues. I mean, it's just stunning. Aside from the fact that, you know, it's one more piece of proof that the right wing, this notion of the tax, the Tea Partiers being about fiscal discipline, bull crap. Moving on, I got a couple more stories here. I just want to get out there. I know, going long. Going way along. In the past year, this is from Mother Jones. Where is this piece? It's by Susie Kim. In the past year, California experienced the worst whooping cough outbreak in more than 50 years, an epidemic that has killed 10 infants and resulted in 6,400 reported cases. But even as the state's public health officials have struggled to curb the disease, Republicans in Congress have proposed slashing millions of dollars in federal funding for immunization programs. The budget would chop $156 million from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. Funding for immunization and respiratory diseases, the GOP reductions are likely to hit the CDC's support. For state and local immunization programs, the agency's ability to evaluate which vaccines are working, and its work to educate the public about recommended vaccines for children, teenagers, and other susceptible populations. This is a direct means in which to kill poor kids. I don't know what else. I mean, that's all. You're going to have a guaranteed rise in the death of predominantly poor children. There can be absolutely no dispute about this. I guarantee you, if these cuts are made, you will have more kids die of communicable diseases that would have otherwise been vaccinated against. in the years following this cut. Guaranteed, no debate. Not to mention, it will not save money in the long run. Health advocates tout vaccines as one of the most cost-effective preventive health strategies, warning that pinching pennies to achieve short-term cost savings would end up costing taxpayers plenty more down the road. A 2008 outbreak of measles in San Diego ended up costing $179,000 to manage at a cost of over $10,000 per case. Similar outbreak in Iowa a few years early cost some $150,000. You will spend more money, you will kill or be responsible for not preventing the deaths. I don't know. Maybe it'll only be 10 babies. Maybe it'll be 100 babies. Who knows? Who knows? Meanwhile, cut from the poureth, giveth to the richeth. Missing from a list of mandatory spending cuts the Agriculture Committee has made or is proposing to make are commodity subsidies, and specifically the $4.9 billion, as opposed to the $150 million they plan to cut from immunizing kids. $4.9 billion in direct payments that are automatically paid out each year in farm subsidies, regardless of whether a person farms. And that same House Agriculture Committee is arguing that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which again helps low-income Americans purchase food. Yeah, like poor people eat. Would make a better target for cuts than automatic subsidies to farms. The move comes as food prices are rising. Department of Agriculture expects overall food prices to rise 3 to 4%, making it harder for the beneficiaries of SNAP, that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to stretch their existing benefits, even as farmers profit from tightening markets. So in other words, we're giving automatic payment agricultural subsidies to people who are benefiting from the rise in food prices and cutting money to poor people so they can afford food. Stunning. Stunning. Well, at least we're getting the stimulus effects of all those missiles we're firing. So there's your job creation. Who's going to make more missiles? Wow, folks. You got a lot of bonus show today. A few members, join me on the flip side. Tomorrow I'll talk about Montana's push against gay people. Stunning. Stunning. And coming up, I will give you an update on my grapevine propagating project. Reed. Man, that's Sam. He's a huge loser. All right, folks. We'll see you on the other side. You can IM me at Majority FM. Do you hear that, folks? That's the sound of silence. Now, I don't want to get too philosophical on you here, but that's the sound you're going to hear if I can't get more members. And who am I going to get to join the Majority Report if not you? People who listen to the show on a daily, maybe thrice weekly basis. Become a member today, support the show, ensure its existence. And on top of that, you're going to get an extra 50 minutes of programming on a daily basis, access to members-only content on majority.fm, and a warm, fuzzy feeling inside of you. Or that also could be some of the swag that I send. Either way, become a member today. And don't forget, we're sponsored by Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. You can get tea, you can get chocolate, you can get coffee, obviously. It's all fair trade, it's delicious, and you can get 10% off by putting majority in the coupon code at justcoffee.coop. So support the show
and enjoy it.